This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers.
Hey, everybody, it's Jessica. And this week, as the election heats up, we have dedicated this episode to talking about all things about the 2024 presidential election. My guest this week is Professor Michael Genovese. He's a professor of political science, the director of the Institute for Leadership Studies, and president of the Global Policy Institute at Loyola Marymount University. In 2006, he was made a fellow at the Queen's College, Oxford University. And in 2017, Professor Genovese was awarded the American Political Science Association's Distinguished Teaching Award, only the fifth time in the APSA's history that this award has been given out. Professor Genovese has also written over 50 books, many of them about presidential powers and the politics of presidential campaigns. He is also a dear friend and colleague, and I'm so excited to bring you this conversation. Professor Michael Genovese, I think listeners of the podcast know that I consider you not only one of the nation's experts when it comes to the presidency and all things political science, as I said, you have published over 50 books, but also a dear friend. And I'm very grateful for your time because knowing you both professionally and personally, I know you're very busy, particularly in September of an election year. So, Michael, welcome back, and thank you for talking with me again.
Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for the nice introduction. You neglected to mention something you sometimes do say, which is that I was the second runner-up in the George Clooney lookalike contest.
It's a pre-taped intro, so you have no idea if I mentioned that or not. You're assuming that I neglected it, but you'll have to wait until the episode goes live to see. Now, we know that you and George Clooney have something else, I should say, in common, which is you both had very strong views of whether or not I think Joe Biden should stay in the race after the debate. And maybe we should pick the conversation up there, which is, it seems like this presidential race became fundamentally different on June 27th, 2024. And that was the date of the first debate. I know you were live giving commentary on TV. Can you tell us what you thought the moment after that debate ended and what you thought would happen in the next days and weeks?
Well, you know, several months prior to the debate, I wrote an essay in which I talked about how Joe Biden might be pushed out. Mm-hmm. It had nothing to do with what happened in the debate. It was just, you know, a lot of factors. So I knew that a lot of Democrats were worried going into November with him at the top of the ticket, not just because they thought they might lose to Donald Trump, but because they feared the down ticket races as well. They didn't want to lose the House and the Senate and the White House. That would have been, for Democrats, catastrophic. But the night of the debate, I watched it with another professor and the news reporter, and we sat there and our jaws dropped. Mm-hmm. We could not believe it. We were critical or he didn't do it. It was so bad that we were frozen.
Yeah.
And
yep.
I don't know if our commentary afterwards was much better than that because we were in shell shock. At that point, two things could have happened. One, we were counting how big a landslide Trump would win by. Or two, we were wondering if the Democrats could push Biden off the ticket and get away with it. It turned out that it was actually a lot easier than I thought. Partly because it didn't have to happen overnight. You took a few weeks, you built momentum, and you ask, you know, what were the big events that moved the needle? And, you know, talking to people, the George Clooney letter that he published in the New York Times seemed to be one of the big factors. The other one was that this Democratic candidates down ballot seemed to really be pushing hard. And I thought, you know, Nancy Pelosi, astute a political mind as there has been in the last 50 years, went out on a limb. She went out a little earlier than some people thought she should. But and Biden really resented it. I can understand his feelings. But she really, I thought, was probably the key in all of that. I thought it would be his wife. I thought it might be the Obamas, but it was I think Nancy Pelosi who was the one who really took us over the top. And think of how sad that is in some respects. I mean, I'm not the greatest Joe Biden fan. I think he was a more effective president than I had anticipated. He did more than I thought he was going to do. So I think if you look into the distance 10, 20 years from now and you ask, you know, how will he be rated? We tend not to rate one-term presidents that highly. And I think that's going to happen with Biden. I think he's going to be appreciated much more like Truman well after he leaves office than when he was in. One of the biggest things we may say about him is he kept the dogs at bay. He beat Donald Trump once, and he paved the way for Donald Trump losing a second time, if that happens. If it does happen that Harris wins, I think some light will be shined upon Joe Biden for doing what he did.
Well, and of course, it would have felt, I think, different in the short term, maybe not the long-term historical view that you point out, but it would have felt different, I think, if he had said 6 months ago, I'm not going to seek a second term. And you mentioned the two of the things that I wanted to follow up on already, of course, which is the power of that George Clooney letter, because I think it really did signal where big donors were. And as we all know, money is the mother's milk of politics. And Nancy Pelosi, because she was ringing the bell for what could happen, not just to the presidency, but for all of those down ballot races. And we know that a president, I mean, you know this better than anybody, cannot govern alone. And she was worried about the Senate and worried about, obviously, Congress for Democrats. How do you think, and I know this is just a thought experiment, but how much did avoiding a primary actually help Kamala Harris? We're talking about the Kamala Harris that we see a few days after the debate. She seems to me to be a stronger, more freed candidate that we've seen in a long time. Could we think that maybe the ability to avoid a primary actually helped her?
She is, to me, a very different person, a different candidate than she was prior to the Biden debate fiasco. Mm-hmm. Why? How? I don't know. Did she grow in office? Was it always there, hidden behind a kind of humbleness or a desire to stay in the background and not overshadow the boss? You know, and Joe Biden is not a scintillating speaker, nor is he a charismatic figure. And maybe she purposely stayed in the background because she didn't want to make him look, you know, less effective or wanted to, you know, step on his position. And so I think there are two things. One, maybe she had it there and she just kept it in the background because she didn't want to look to be better than the president. Or maybe the way it happened, how quickly it happened, she found herself. She found a voice and she found a drive and a confidence that I did not see in her. When she first ran for president, I thought she did a terrible job. I'm not alone. She gave us no reason to vote for her. Now she is older, more experienced, more mature, and I think going through the fire that she went through, that changed her in some ways. I see as a completely different Kamala Harris. She always had the prosecutor in her, and you saw that in the debate a few nights ago. But what you didn't see is the self-confidence that she clearly now has, the sense of drive that she clearly has. Whereas before, you didn't get that impression as a vice president. She seemed to be willingly in the shadow. She could have stepped forward. I think she probably should have on a few issues. But maybe this is the real Harris. And if it is, well, look what it took to get her to this point. So I think that difference between Harris pre-Biden debate and post is just enormous. They're two different people, in my view.
Well, and this new Harris, she is facing an old electoral map in the sense that, as you and I know, and we've spent so much time talking about, this is not about how many votes you get. It's about whether or not you can win the electoral college. And we spend so much time talking about it, but it is the swing states and it's the swing voters in the swing states. And we've now seen Kamala Harris as candidate for president of the United States for a few months now, or close to a few months. What do you think, if you were advising her, and I know that you have been in positions of advising people in very high level officials when it comes to leadership and being effective, how would you advise her in terms of getting through this next 50 plus days?
Well, the first thing I'd say is don't listen to me. Listen to the people who are talking in your ear now, because they are obviously doing a pretty good job. I would also say that, and you touched on it at the very beginning of the question, this is not a presidential race. This is 50 different presidential races. And that's because of the scandal of the Electoral College. It is an anti-democratic element in the American system. It has no place. It has no real purpose, no constructive purpose. It was written into our Constitution to satisfy slave-owning states and smaller states so that they could get a bargain and a compromise. So they would support this new Constitution. It was a devil's bargain from the beginning, and we suffer from it today. People who live in Wyoming have, about 3.6 votes to every one that we have in terms of Electoral College influence. So the concept of one person, one vote is out the window. The concept of us being a democracy is out the window, and we need to change it. We need to go to direct election. She has to win by at least 4%, experts say, to try to mitigate against the Electoral College bias against Democrats, against liberals. That's a lot to win by in a deeply divided and evenly divided country. I mean, our two parties are just neck and neck. They're as close as two coats of paint. And how do you differentiate yourself? Well, you have a state-by-state strategy, and that's what's happened. Right? We have seven states that are going to get over 90% of all the money spent in this coming election. 90%.
Amazing.
Seven states.
Yeah.
Places like California are going to be afterthoughts. And so a lot of states, especially the bigger states, get the short end of the stick on this. It's all because of the corruption of the Electoral College. It corrupts our democracy in a way that is dysfunctional for all of us. And so what I would say to Harris is you have to make you have three different places to look in no particular order. The Southwest. You can go for Arizona and Nevada. They're both in play. Anyone could win those states. You focus on those states. You go to the South. Try to get North Carolina and Georgia. Again, both in play. Winning those would be huge. Or do you do what most Democrats do, which is go to the blue wall in the Midwest and try to get Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan? Obama did it. Biden did it. But Trump also did it in 2016. So right now it looks like it's anyone's game in the Midwest. So you've got to make some very difficult strategic decisions. You concentrate on one of those three. If you do, it's going to be the Midwest. Do you go for two out of three, the South and the Southwest? There's just no strategy that presents itself. That's the obvious answer. The most obvious, though, is the Midwest. And I think that the road to the White House is paved through Pennsylvania. I'm not going to say that whoever wins Pennsylvania wins the race, but I'd almost be willing to say that.
It's astounding in the sense that it emphasizes what you said, which is that this is not a national election. And in fact, it's an election really that just comes down to those few states. I want to emphasize, because I called this up while you were talking, you mentioned Wyoming. So we have California with 39 million people, 54 electoral college votes, meaning each electoral college vote in California represents 722,000 people. In Wyoming, 581,000 people, three electoral college votes, meaning each electoral college vote in Wyoming represents about 193,000 people. That's a huge difference in your power to elect the next leader of the free world, depending on which state you are living in. So Kamala Harris obviously is running an election, as we talked about, in a few states, and we all know her opponent very well because he is a former president of the United States. So I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked about Kamala Harris, which is, what do you think he needs to do? So we know that they need to focus on specific states. My guess is going into the debate, you would have advised him, as I think a number of people did, that he should try and control his emotions and look like somebody who none of us fear being within a whisper of launching a potential nuclear war, somebody who seems very even keeled. What does he need to do to convince those swing voters to vote for him in November?
One thing he needs to do is listen to his advisors, who are all telling him the same thing, which is tone it down. They all said to Trump, tone down the crazy, talk policy, because you'll win. And if he does talk policy, he has some real advantages. People are upset at the economy. They're upset with the border, and they're upset with crime. Now, crime is lower than it has been in decades. Our economy is the strongest in the world, but people felt inflation and they feel fear. So it's not rational. It's not, you're not basing your decisions on evidence. If you're basing it on evidence, crime is down. The economy is in actually pretty good shape. The border is a mess. Absolutely. And if you're Donald Trump and if you talk about those things every single day, and that's all you talk about, you win the election, because the American public is on his side on those issues. Why doesn't he do it? Because he can't help himself. You see him every time he's on stage. He starts to say the right things. He starts to read from the teleprompter and then turns away and plays to his audience. They encourage him. They encourage the worst in him. And he walks right into it. Donald Trump is his own worst enemy. And so he needed to tone down the crazy. And Harris needed to uplift herself. She did that. He didn't. He went right into full crazy mode. And what do we remember from it? She got into his head and stayed there the whole time. And he let her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she played him the whole time. If I were Trump's folks, I would say, you can win Georgia and North Carolina. Go there a lot. Send Vance there. He seems somewhat popular there, not many other places. And then you spend your time in the Midwest. And I think there's an easier path for Donald Trump to win than for Kamala Harris. Having said that, I don't know what the impact of young voters will be. And I don't know what the impact of, you know, Taylor Swift getting involved is.
Mm-hmm.
We know that in almost every case, celebrity endorsements mean next to nothing. People find it interesting, but they don't change their votes on that. Is this a different case? Because number one, it's a new world with social media. I mean, what does she have? Over 280 million Instagram followers, Taylor Swift has.
More than enough votes.
That's almost as many people as there are in the U.S. And, you know, and she signs her open letter, you know, a childless cat lady, as a real dig at the Republicans. Will she have an impact? The only place I think she might have is in women and young voters, especially young women. They might see her as a role model that they want to emulate, and they might follow that. There's no real track record of it. Taylor Swift went out on a limb. I mean, she took a chance. Will it matter? I don't know. But if you can energize young people, especially young women, because the abortion issue is still so important, Harris can steal a couple of states that she might otherwise lose.
Well, and I've seen recently, I mean, the larger question about whether or not we can trust polling, but polling indicating that Joe Biden did much better in terms of at least numbers at this point, with respect to non-college educated voters, with respect to Latinos, and that Harris is facing different challenges, let's say, than Joe Biden. And, you know, with respect to Taylor Swift, I mean, as you say, we will see. We know that voter registration websites saw huge upticks. Now, whether or not a Instagram-like translates into a vote is the thing that I think you and I are really curious about. I want to pick up on, because we know that very rationally the economy is the number one issue for voters, because that affects their daily lives. You know, whether or not they have enough money for gas, food, for their children's extracurricular activities, for basic needs, everything from basic to the things that feel luxurious to a lot of people. Now, I also am under the understanding that a president can only do so much when it comes to the economy. Could you help unpack for us a little bit, what should we really be thinking about when we think about who's better on the economy? What are the questions we should really be asking? What can a president really do?
Presidents can do very little, but we expect them to do a lot. We demand that they do a lot, and they promise a lot. So it's partly a function of their promises that they shouldn't be making, but that they electorally feel compelled to make. It's partly a problem of the fact that we are such a president-centric system that voters think the president has more power than he or she has, and therefore they expect them to accomplish things that they don't have the power or the resources to accomplish. And so what happens is we judge them very quickly and very harshly. And because of that, presidents don't want to sit back and go, well, I guess I don't have the power, so I won't get it done. There's a temptation to go beyond the legitimate limits of power and the rule of law by using executive authority, sometimes by breaking the law, sometimes going beyond what they're constitutionally permitted to do, because they don't want to be losers. They don't want to be seen as a loser. But this is also a big problem for the public. And presidents help create the expectations. But in a way, you can see why the public thinks this. If you look at the amount of attention on television that presidents get compared to the Congress or the Supreme Court, It's an enormous difference in the media. We on television, we all talk about the president and look to the president. And so we create this kind of electronic throne without changing the Constitution. And so we see the president and we think, oh, it's really a tale of one branch of government, but it's really a tale of three. And when we don't think of the other branches and the necessary cooperation and syncopation that you need to get things done, consensus building, bargaining, compromising, working together, what we do is we throw everything on the shoulders of the president and say, do it, get it done. You're the president. You're the central figure. We see you all the time. We don't see members of Congress very often. We hardly ever see the courts unless they make some decision that's monumental. You're the guy that we see every day. You're the guy that has the power, but he really doesn't. And so it's a combination of presidents stoking that and the public buying into this notion that it's really one dominant branch of government.
Right.
When it clearly isn't. And I'm not saying the branches are co-equal. They are not. And I also know that modernization has put a premium on presidential leadership because the presidency is built for speed. Whereas Congress is a deliberative body that takes a lot of time. So there are all kinds of reasons why you might want to give more power to a president. But the Constitution is what the Constitution is. And presidents then have to get Congress to do most of the big things. Presidents try to do a lot through executive orders, but those are pretty flimsy when you think about history and how Biden comes in and undoes what Trump did through executive orders. And if Trump gets in, he'll undo what Biden did. And it's just this roller coaster ride. The gold standard is still legislation. And presidents are very weak regarding Congress, even when they have a majority in both houses because of the rules. For example, in the Senate, you need 60 votes. And so, what can the presidents do? They can jawbone a little bit. They can try to get. Let's go back to Biden. I think he did more than any of the last three or four presidents did on the economy with the stimulus bill. And that was unusual that he got it through. I was shocked that it got through. So you can have an impact, but it's so hard to get things like that through, especially if you have a razor-thin majority or if you have divided government. There's no really incentive for a Democrat to help a Republican president or Republicans to help a Democratic president. In fact, with gerrymandering the way we have it in congressional districts, there are very few moderate districts or competitive districts in Congress. There are a lot of really conservative and a lot of really liberal districts. And people who are elected in those districts, they are elected to fight the battle, not to solve the problems. And so, you don't have many institutionalists in Congress left, don't have many people who are willing to bargain and compromise. The number of moderates in Congress, moderate left, moderate right, has diminished to not single digits, but it's almost single digits. Whereas it used to be that was the body. Those were the majority. And that's why they could talk to one another. They could come up with a deal. They don't make deals anymore, rarely make deals anymore because they don't have to.
So I don't know that I want to end on a deeply depressing note, but I want to ask why that is. So you talked about, I think, what we're all seeing, right? Which is there aren't that many moderates, that hyperpolarization is the status quo, that's normal now. And I could ask you so many questions about ways that we could fix our government, but I want to ask you, how did we get here? I mean, I know a lot of Republicans who don't support Donald Trump. I know a lot of moderates who feel like there is no party for them on either side. And I'm just wondering, how did we go from let's make a deal to let's storm the Capitol?
I think there are a couple of things we should point to. One is the new media universe that tends to get rewarded the crazier you are. You get a bigger audience by being more extreme and by being more bloodthirsty. I'll reveal a lot about myself when I say this, but I try to watch Fox News as much as I can. I don't have a stomach for it for very long because it is so ugly. And people who watch it think it's great. God bless you for that. But the new media universe allows us to be ugly and to say ugly things and to pass those ugly things off as fact, as evidence. The second thing is that more technical, what I mentioned, which is gerrymandering. But I think there are two other big reasons. One is race. I think ever since 1964, when Lyndon Johnson knowingly damaged the Democratic Party by pushing civil rights legislation through and losing the South, race has been a cleavage in America that has just ripped our soul apart. And again, I was one of those people who was wishing and hoping that when Barack Obama said, I want to be a post-racial president, maybe we could turn that corner. No, it made it worse because a lot of people came out of the woodwork who hated having a black person in the White House. The other is the rise of women's rights, tremendously positive in my view. But there are a lot of males who feel deeply challenged by that, by the belief that their country is taken over by them, by the other, and who are, you look at the Republican convention, and it was an absolute festival of testosterone. We addressed the rise of women in the women's movement, and it's been incredibly positive. We haven't really addressed the fears that men have. And there are a lot of men out there, especially those who are not going to college. And you know as well as I do, 60% of college students today are women. A majority of, in almost all the fields, a majority of the new people who go into these fields are women. More women in law school, medical school. One of the few still male-dominated fields is engineering. But women are getting educated, and they're getting advanced degrees, and they're getting professional degrees, and men have not done it at the same pace. So it's going to get worse for men. So that's another problem that we have not addressed, and it's hard to address. It's hard to talk about those kinds of issues. It's hard to talk about race. People feel uncomfortable. It's hard to talk about gender equality. I think it's going to be even harder nowadays to talk about masculinity. And that's why the Democratic candidate for Vice President Walz is kind of the regular guy model of masculinity, a guy who will help his neighbor out. The scene in his speech when his son thus stood up tearful, going, "That's my dad, that's my dad." Mm-hmm. That to me was the best part of either of the conventions. And the response was quite negative in right-wing media circles. There's a problem with our understanding of manhood and what masculinity is. If we don't address that, it's going to come back and haunt us even further.
Well, you gave me so many places that I could have followed up if I hadn't asked you for half of the time that we've already gone way over. And I know that our window on this particular discussion is closing, but you and I get to have discussions as co-professors, thanks to you inviting me to be able to tag along on some of your classes. So I would like to actually end with where we start in our fall class that we're teaching right now, which is a prediction. And this is only a prediction for right now. It's the middle of September. The debate has happened. And I would like to ask, maybe you don't have to say, here's who I think will win, or this is what I think it hinges on, is more than fine for me, but President, House, and Senate.
Oh, boy. I'm a big believer in probabilistic thinking, and so I tend not to say person X will win. I think there's still a likelihood but it's a narrow likelihood that Donald Trump will win the presidency. I think the game is set up for that, partly because of the Electoral College bias, that Harris has to win 4%, maybe more. To what extent will gender be an issue that hurts her the way it did Hillary? To what extent will race be a factor that hurts her? And then, of course, the Electoral College. So does she have to win by 5% to win? So that's why I think the game is rigged, and it's rigged in Donald Trump's favor. Now, a month ago, 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago, I was saying, without hedging my bets, Donald Trump. Who's going to win the House? Who's going to win the Senate? Yes.
Yes.
I don't have an answer for that. Check with me come late October. I want to see how what's happened in the last 3 weeks plays out. I want to see if Donald Trump needed to cut the momentum that Harris had. He didn't do it. But you have ups and downs in campaigns. She hasn't had the down yet. If she has the down, what's going to happen? Will she be able to recover? Or can she keep going and keep winning and running well, and her victory then is seen as an inevitability? I don't. There's so much that can happen. Presidents tend not to have the kinds of coattails they used to have, where they bring people in. But there's still a little bit of that. But in a deeply divided race, in those races, a lot of local issues are going to be important. Local personalities are going to be important. And you can't nationalize House races the way you used to be. I'm going to cop out. I'm going to be a meanie and say, I don't know.
I don't know if that's a cop out so much as it's impossible to predict. And anybody who says they can wants to just sound a certain way. So I appreciate the considered response. Professor Michael Genovese, I appreciate you coming back and sharing your wisdom with us. And I hope that this is not the last conversation we have on this podcast before the election.
I would love to come back.